Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
It began with a sound that no one was ever supposed to hear.
He's one of us.
Yes, he says he pulled a girl out of the car.
I would like you to forget about her.
Yeah, that's what I heard just before the tire blew out. You're right, it was a shot.
He recorded a murder. They say it never happened.
There are still loose ends, witnesses. The girl, I've decided to terminate her. Terminate her. Terminate her.
Brian De Palma's Blowout. Now you hear it. Now you don't.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Joining me is Mr. Rob St. Mary.
Hey, I heard that.
Also joining us this week is the host of the Movie Geeks United podcast, Mr. Jamie Duvall.
It's an honor to be here with you guys to talk about this terrific movie.
This week we are talking about the terrific movie Blowout from 1981, directed by Brian De Palma. Blowout stars John Travolta as Jack Terry, a sound man for low-budget horror films who becomes embroiled in a political cover-up when he sees, or hears rather, something he shouldn't. This brings him into contact with Nancy Allen as a potential Mary Jo Kopechne, Dennis Franz as a scuzzy private eye, and John Lithgow as a crazed killer. This film was hot on the heels of what was Brian De Palma's biggest hit at the time, Dressed to Kill, and was not as entirely successful as it could have been or should have been, as to me, it's one of his best thrillers. So, Jamie, when did you first see Blowout, and what were your thoughts when you first saw it?
Well, I was a pretty established De Palma fan by the time I got around to seeing it, but it was probably the middle school, early high school. I was on a De Palma kick. So I rented every video I could find at the store, so everything like Carrie and Dressed to Kill and Blowout was in there. And even at that young age, Blowout's for me stood out as his most mature work in the thriller genre particularly.
I think I saw it years ago, much like Jamie was saying, getting on a kick of directors and just watching all their stuff. But to be honest, it had probably been 20 years since I've seen it, so it was nice to go back and check it out just recently.
I think I also saw it when I was on a De Palma kick, or moreover, when my friend Mike Thompson was on a De Palma kick and recommended that one to me. And I have to say, when I first saw it, I loved it. But I knew that I was missing so much of the film because I saw it probably like you guys on VHS for the first time, and it was pan and scan or cropped or whatever. It was not widescreen. So I was literally missing half of the movie. I mean, the movie is so beautifully composed, so many great uses of these diopters, this widescreen composition, all this kind of stuff. Seeing it on VHS was one of the most frustrating experiences of my life. So when it came out on Laserdisc years and years ago, I didn't buy it on Laserdisc, but I made sure to rent it on Laser and copy it over to VHS so I could have a widescreen version of it, and then was finally able to enjoy the film quite a bit more. It was such a revelation seeing this one in its original aspect ratio. Let's talk a little bit more about the movie, how it starts and everything. I love how this movie kind of takes you in. You know, like I said, it was hot on the heels of Dressed to Kill. And it's right, I mean, it's, what, a couple years after Halloween comes out and the slasher movie genre or subgenre, whatever you want to call it, is very popular at this time. And really, he starts us off in a slasher film. And I love the way that he's doing it. And I love the way that he's basically mimicking Carpenter with the whole use of the Steadicam and everything, and just kind of leading us into this story and then quickly pulling the rug right out from under our feet and introducing us to this world of the Sound Man and introducing us to Jack Terry.
That opening Steadicam POV is just amazing to look at, and it's hilarious once you find out what's going on. Rewatching it for the first time, and like I said, probably 20 years, I didn't remember this scene, and I was like, oh, this is really interesting. I'm like, okay. And just basically the further it goes on, sort of the cornier and more ridiculous it gets, and it's a total like parody send-up of, as you were saying, like Halloween and Friday the 13th and stuff like that that had just come out.
What it also does for me is it kind of subverts expectations. And it says that, you know, what has become of the thriller genre in which I work? You know, it's become schlocky and obvious and cartoony. And then when it ends, that opening sequence, I feel that that's De Palma saying, now I'm going to give you thriller that's actually about something. The antithesis of what I opened this movie with, what a lot of thrillers have become now, you know, all the Halloween knockoffs that came after that film initially was released in 78.
I mean, I guess you could even say that Dress to Kill was a little bit of a slasher. I mean, it was a literal slasher with a razor blade and everything. And this one does feel so much more mature to me. And I know a lot of people love Dress to Kill. I think I've only seen it once, and I really have no desire to go back to it. So many of his other films are so much more interesting to me. Body Double, I absolutely love and will go back to any time. Or Sisters, I find to be fascinating. Carrie, of course, we covered Phantom of the Paradise in the past. With this one, I think you're right. It feels like he is saying, you know, now it's time to get serious. And it definitely, this is a lot more serious of a film, though it does seem to be having fun with it. And I like the way that he's subverting our expectations right up front and then introducing this whole idea of the importance of sound. And even in the following scene where Jack goes back into his workroom and he's playing, you know, the thunder sound effects and everything, we've got the TV in the front. We're paying attention to Jack and paying attention to the TV. I think that's one of the first of these kind of near to the camera, far away kind of action things that we have in the film, though there are several of these. And he's already setting up the story, talking about the Liberty Day celebration going on in Philadelphia while Jack's working on his sound effects and getting ready to go out recording. And I just love the way that the story unfolds, I think is so clever. And really, there are times where, you know, I've watched this probably like four times just this week alone, and I get more out of it. Even like the fourth time, like redoing it today, I got even more out of it than I have in the previous times. And then up till now, I probably have seen this film, I don't know, a couple dozen times, but it still does not fail to give me something new with each viewing.
Another thing that that opening sequence signifies, I remember seeing an interview with Garrett Brown, the inventor of the Steadicam and the operator of it in most movies when it was in its early days. And it was in its early days around the time of Blowout. And he was so excited to be working with De Palma and shooting that opening sequence from the POV of the knife-wielding killer. And then he found out how they were going to shoot it in this terribly cheesy, technically sloppy manner. And he was so disappointed, you know, his state-of-the-art invention, and he's using it this way. But in a way, that's what that opening sequence says. And you have the beauty of the filmmaking medium and all the advances and all the technical gadgets that are used to bring it to life, and you're employing it to create complete and total schlock. And we're going to be talking about what the movie's actually about and what it has to say a little bit later in the show, I'm sure, but that kind of mirrors what the movie has to say about America and politics in America, about how we've kind of cheapened it. So I'm pretty sure that's a theme that's going to come back up in our conversation. But that's always been a fascinating aspect to me with that opening scene as well.
Yeah, I mean, he was hot off of The Shining, mm-hmm. which was one of the most beautiful uses of Steadicam and one of the first uses of it, and just is used so effectively. And then, yeah, I think there's an interview with him on the Criterion disc and him talking about the way he had to, like, move himself back and forth. So you got the footsteps of the camera operator, a.k.a. the, you know, the killer in that opening and stuff. And it's just like, this is ridiculous. At least they got to use it more effectively later on. You know?
Especially when he just got done working with the very exacting Kubrick. I mean, this was the polar opposite.
In that scene, it was the polar opposite, but I think De Palma is as much of a craftsman as Kubrick is. Maybe not as... I don't know. I think, yeah, even when it comes to the details, I think he's right there when it comes to the details as well. Because there's some things later on in the film that I want to talk about where it almost feels like there's some mistakes, but I'm pretty sure that they're on purpose.
Well, he has a lot in common with Kubrick. And I do think it's the composition is very strong in a De Palma film as it is in a Kubrick film. But also the tone, the very cynical tone. They both share that quality.
The repetition of some of the images and stuff, like that hallway that we see in the studio, you know, constantly going back and forth on that. And that's, I think, another nice use of the camera, kind of, you know, following Jack in and following him out and everything. There's the scene later on with a reporter where he goes down the hall and comes back. And we see that kind of repeated a few times where Jack is coming in and out, where you could just skip right past that, but I think every single time it, you know, reminds us of the world that Jack is in because of that corridor being lined with all of those posters. And I have to laugh because, you know, the end poster is for Without Warning by Graydon Clark, and it's just like every single time I'm just like, oh, hey, there's Graydon's movie.
You were talking about the following scene where he's doing the sound effects and putting them together, and you see him in the environment in which he works. You were talking about the news reports playing in the extreme foreground and him putting together the sound effects in the background. I mean, this can be in another director's film, this can be very draining exposition. I mean, he's setting up story. But what's interesting to me about De Palma is he doesn't believe in coverage. He doesn't believe in the typical medium shot, close up over the shoulder, then on the other side over the shoulder. He thinks that's lazy directing. He gives you all of this important information in a very exciting visual way. And I'm sure you noticed it when it cuts in the newscast to the presidential candidate, the front runner. As soon as it cuts to him, Travolta's playing that sound effect of the gunshot.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of a foreshadowing. That's beautiful. I love touches like that.
Even when it comes to him playing like the wind and the thunder sound effects and all this kind of stuff, it's almost like a mini version of the movie's soundtrack, you know, all within the first few minutes of the film, which I love. And then, yeah, he goes out after that and starts recording all of these sound effects. And I love that scene too, just the use of foreground, background, the owl in the foreground, that shot when he's kind of letting his microphone lead him. And I like that too, where he is just out there capturing these sounds and just seeing what nature is going to give him, basically, or see what the world will give him. Of course, when it comes to De Palma and his love of Hitchcock and everything, you know, we've talked about voyeurism so much in Hitchcock's films and voyeurism so much in De Palma's films, like in Greetings, you have the peeper character and all this kind of stuff. But in this one, it's like this, I don't know, not a scopophiliac, but a autophiliac or something, where it's just him scanning around, not with his eyes, but with his mic and trying to find, you know, illicit behavior or good sound effects that way, like him focusing on the couple that's on the bridge. And, you know, it seems like maybe they're not supposed to be there, but they're having their little conversation, which kind of, to me, brought to mind a lot of Francis Ford Coppola's The Conversation.
He'd kill us if he got the chance.
Well, this was definitely inspired by Blow Up and The Conversation. It was kind of the in concert with those two influences, and then he took it to a different place. So there are definitely elements of both films that are very strong in there.
The one thing that I thought was interesting is after the scene happens with the accident, he's back in his like audio library and he's listening to the tape back with his eyes closed and he's got this pencil and you see him sort of pointing and reconfiguring in his mind sort of where he was placing things in order to get that sound so that he can sort of replay the scene in his head.
And I love that it's then from his point of view, like his microphone is his eyes in that scene. Like before we kind of had him as a character and you can see him juxtapose, you know, shot of him, shot of say the frog. And in that one, it's more like his camera or his pencil, his microphone in this case, is his eyes, you know, because you can see the frog from a different perspective than you could see it before, which I really thought was very clever.
He experiences the world through sound. I mean, that's his job. That's his expertise. And I think the way it is shot, you know, directors, they always talk about establishing a point of view for the characters in a big way. In this film, De Palma is establishing a point of sound with the way he uses the camera. And even in the service of the split diopter shots, there's a scene in the hospital that I know we haven't gotten to that scene yet, but you know, you can hear faint sounds in the background and then you hear his name mentioned and then it cuts from the side of his face in the extreme foreground. In the background, he starts to pick up the conversation that they're having about him and how he witnessed the accident.
This guy, Jack Terry, who took her out of the car, that's him over there. He's being a real horse's ass. I don't know if you keep the lid on this.
The camera really plays a role, almost it assumes the position of Jack's ears throughout a lot of the film, which is fitting because that's sound is so crucially important in this film.
I can't say it's background sound. It really is foreground sound, but the people who are saying it aren't in the foreground because we're paying, you know, we're still with Jack at that point.
It kind of reminds me of being in a party or something, you know, where there's a sort of a lot of sound going on, and then you hear your name, and then all of a sudden you focus in on where that's coming from. Or someone says a name that's your name, but might not be you. They might not be talking about you. And that's where the focus goes. So just the idea of how sound also is processed and how we relate to it within the environment, I think is interesting, as you were saying with that scene.
Yeah, I was talking to my friend Bob St. Derry, and he agreed completely with that.
Yeah.
We have kind of met Nancy Allen, the Sally character, met her through the accident that Jack witnesses with his ears and with his eyes, even though he kind of denies later on that he saw the accident. There's a great line where somebody says, you know, I want you to tell me what you saw and what you heard.
Listen, Jack, you realize this won't mean a thing unless you come on the air and you say it's what you saw and what you heard.
I'll say it's what I heard.
You know, he doesn't even rely on his eyes when it comes to being a, you know, the ear witness, as one of the other characters says later on.
Look, let me tell you something. I was there. That tire was shot out. I heard it. I recorded it.
So you're an ear witness to an assassination. That's good. It's got a nice ring. I like that.
Jack saves Sally, pulls her out of this sinking car. We've got the governor, who might have been the next president, in the car with him, setting off this whole political intrigue. So what did you guys think about Nancy Allen as Sally?
She seems almost childlike at times, and childlike to a point that for me is a bit annoying. It's almost like she's so oblivious to what's going on and so sort of naive that you almost it was kind of hard for me to have sympathy for her at times, because I'm like, you're so dumb that you can't even kind of figure this out. There's just parts where she just seems way too, like, 10 years younger than she should be. She seems like a girl in her early teens or something. It's just, I don't know why I got that feeling, but I definitely did in the early go. And then as she progresses, it gets better. Like, the character gets a little bit hipper to what's going on and sort of realizes the implications of what she's dealing with.
It's a tough performance to grapple with in many ways, and I think it was a completely brave choice the way she chose to play it, because you could see her as a complete airheaded bimbo at movie start, you know, with the high voice and the, you think it's too exaggerated. But I think she starts with a stereotype and she slowly humanizes it. And I think that her idealism, her kind of wide-eyed idealism is very fitting with the theme of the movie, because she's, you know, she's a stereotypical hooker with a heart of gold. You know, in her position, she probably has seen a lot of terrible things in life, and yet she maintains that kind of wide-eyed, dreamy innocence some way. While Travolta's character, he's grasping at the last straws of his idealism. And this is, you know, through the course of the movie, this is his one chance to try to make things right. I like the contrast between those two characters. I like that the innocence in her is exaggerated.
Yeah, there's a telling moment towards the end of the film. I know we'll eventually get to it, but I kind of want to throw this out here now. Do you guys see her as just being kind of, I know this is going to sound really freaking ponderous, but do you see her as kind of more of a symbol of America's innocence? And, you know, maybe Jack is somebody who's kind of like post-60s, whereas maybe she's a little bit pre-60s kind of thing. Do you see her as kind of that desire for a simpler, better time, and that she kind of lets some of these things, because she has been in these bad places that you said, Jamie, you know, like the, you know, you see her caught in one of these, you know, candid motel photograph kind of things, but yet she doesn't seem like she's that person. She just seems to be kind of oblivious and wants to just move on with things and look for the better, you know, way, whereas Jack doesn't. Do you see her as that symbol of innocence?
I think you could very easily see her as that. She's got her blinders on to the dangers of the world around her, but she can't escape them forever. You know, I think that there's a reason why she's killed in front of a big American flag at the end of the film. I mean,
spoilers.
Oh, I'm sorry. it's pretty hard to avoid when you're talking about where that character actually goes and what she means to the story. You know,
right.
Her demise. Yeah, I think that's a beautiful reading, and I love how you use the term countercultural, counterculture, because De Palma is a countercultural filmmaker. He's always been a political-minded filmmaker, and I think that both of these characters kind of represent that in some way.
As much as the film is the story of Jack Terry, it feels like the movie is the story of Sally, because really she's the one that interacts the most with other characters. Other than seeing Manny Karp on TV, Jack doesn't interface with Manny whatsoever. Other than their brief encounter at the very end of the film, Jack doesn't interact with the John Lithgow character. It's like she is the one that we see so much of the stuff through. It's almost like she's the eyes and Jack is the ears.
Well, there's also the voyeur aspect. I mean, there's a voyeur in a lot of De Palma films, and I think that Jack is the voyeur in this film, and as such, I mean, it's just by definition, it's about keeping your distance, observing from a distance.
You could say that there are several voyeurs in this film, because Manny Karp makes a living off of photographing people, and he's out there being the eyes when McRyan's car goes off of the bridge or the road into the water. And then you've got the John Lithgow character, Burke, who he's constantly observing people, and he's, you know, following these women around and, you know, doing this whole series of sex crimes to be able to lay this groundwork. But you constantly see him spying on different people, you know, whether he's following them directly or he's, you know, in the phone booth and watching people, you know. So it's an interesting story of who's watching who and who knows what when, because that's the other thing that I find very interesting about this one is the way that we're being handed information. Like I was talking about with the television earlier, which kind of comes back a few times. I mean, there's, like I said, Manny, we see him on the TV, and that's when, you know, Jack's buddy comes in and turns on the television set for him. But there's this whole idea of when do we know things versus when Jack knows them, like Burke putting the replacement tire in with the car, with McRyan's car, we know that before Jack knows, you know, and Jack is insisting, like, check the tire, you know. And it's like, okay, we already know that that's going on. And then we know as well, like, because we have Burke saying, I erased all of his tapes, so they're going to think he's crazy. We know that, I think, before Jack knows. And we get that amazing scene of Jack going in and playing all of his tapes and having everything coming out blank. And that whole camera move, you know, I don't want to say 360 because that would kind of imply that the camera was in one spot and just turning around, because that camera is really exploring the space and going around throughout the entire room. And just the way that we run into Jack as you're going around clockwise is just a remarkable set piece.
I think that's the tragedy of that character too, is that he is always one step behind. He just can't solve it. There's a kind of there's a destroyed idealism about that character, and he's so desperate to get it back, and he just can't do it. He meets with disappointment at every turn.
Yeah, like when he tells his story, I mean, it's pretty soon after he meets Sally that they get to talking about, she talks about how she works at the makeup counter at Corvettes and how she could fix Barbara Streisand's face and all this stuff. And she starts pressing him as to how he got into the sound business. And, you know, it starts off fairly normally. Oh, yeah, I was this whiz kid, you know, and I was working in radios and all this kind of stuff. And then it just turns so dark so quickly. And, man, every time that scene plays, it just gets me, because I feel for Jack. And it's almost like this whole, like, I want him to be able to change his destiny so badly. Every time I watch this film, I'm just like, if only he were a few seconds earlier when he had this bad experience as a cop, not being able to save that guy. To me, that moment, like, we know that Tarantino was a big fan of this film, and, you know, he talked about it a lot when he was, you know, bringing Travolta back with Pulp Fiction. But to me, that scene of Jack talking about him wiring up this cop.
Mackie, hand me the tape. Okay, Freddie, give me a sound check. Count to 10.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
It was a great wire, man. It was one of these deals where he could be blocks away and you could hear everything within 10 feet of him. Fantastic.
Hey, Milt, how you doing?
Hello, Freddie, how you doing?
Good to see you.
Nice seeing you. You look good.
Yeah, so do you. You look like a million in that getup.
Thank you.
So, I brought somebody here I want you to meet. Captain Kennedy, this is Milt.
Man, who the fuck wants to meet Captain Kennedy?
Milt, take it easy.
Hey, no squitch of the folly. I don't want to meet him.
Hey, take it easy. This man could put the cap on everything. You won't be able to go to the bathroom alone.
All right, come on in the car. We'll take a ride and we'll talk a little bit.
All right. And the first thing that the captain says to the mob guy, he says,
look, I understand that the man has a brother-in-law. Okay? Now, I happen to see him talking to his brother-in-law. Now, the brother-in-law is a known felon, Freddie, and Milt's out on parole, and that's a parole violation. Now, I'm going to have to tell the parole officer, okay? If I tell the parole officer, he's going back in the can. But I think I could work something out that I don't have to tell him for $5,000.
$5,000? Freddie, you little brick. We started this thing for $1,000. Now, wait a minute.
I'm getting this $1, clear as a bell on tape, and I started to hear the static.
You think you're doing your out of your... We can work this thing out.
You're telling me not to...
Up.
He's going up the river. You understand?
Right.
He told me. What's the matter?
I help
you're
you.
Sweating, Freddie. What's the matter?
The one thing the fucking whiz kid didn't think of was maybe that Freddie would get nervous and he'd sweat.
What was that of me?
He's sweating so bad that the battery in the transmitter is shorting out and burning a hole in him.
Hey, pull over at this gas station. I gotta take a piss.
Wrong, Joe. Batteries.
battery's arcing.
The battery's arcing?
My battery and the transmitter's arcing. It's burning them. I gotta get in there.
You can't go in there. You're gonna blow the guy's cover.
I gotta go in there.
You can't
go in there. My fucking battery's burning a hole in them.
I don't give a damn. You're gonna screw things up.
Shh.
Jack, I think you're nuts.
That feels so Tarantino-esque. You know, that feels like such a moment that he would just relish.
It's an interesting role for Travolta at an interesting time in his career. I mean, it's the observation has been made that this feels like the first adult role that Travolta had. He's in his prime. It's 1981. He's great looking. He's obviously got major movie star quality in a terrific, empathetic feel that he brings to that character. It's someone that you can't help but empathize with and root for.
I don't know if it's fair to say that this was his first adult role. This is definitely a very adult role for Travolta. And I would say that this is definitely one of the most serious films up to this point that I think that De Palma made. But I think, you know, if you go back, and I know you've talked to John Badham and you're familiar with Saturday Night Fever, going back and watching that movie when I was in my 20s and really seeing Saturday Night Fever for the first time and not thinking of it just as like, or, you know, I thought of it as I'm walking in the door as this is the disco movie, and then realizing just how frickin' dark that movie is. Mm. It's like, wow, this one is really serious. Like the scene on the bridge in that film is like, whoa, okay, yeah, this isn't for kids.
Yeah, I agree with you, but Saturday Night Fever is a John Travolta who, by movie's end, he is kind of forced to grow up.
Right.
And in Blowout, you could tell this man has tragedy in his life. He's tormented. I mean, he's lived a life and experienced things and had time to reflect and be tortured over those things.
And I do love that this kind of is his second chance. You know, what you said earlier about this is his chance to make things right and to kind of, you know, redeem himself a little bit after the tragedy that he feels very responsible for, even though, I don't know, it was his fault that he didn't think about the guy that he wired sweating and burning himself. And he feels very responsible for that cop dying. And I can see it and I can't, but I can understand why he would feel that way. And, you know, now he's taking on this kind of new journey to in trying to set it right and redeem himself in his own eyes, almost.
Obviously, he is a character who has been around a while. He's not really happy with his job. You kind of feel that him working with this B-movie factory kind of thing is like, oh, you know, it's easy work. It's something I can do. The work that I do is kind of crap. These movies aren't very good, but whatever. It's just, it to me, it's the job of a man who, when we learn the backstory of working with this other officer who was killed, it's the job you get that's related to your previous job, but has none of the stress and or importance of your original job. It's kind of like a cop that becomes a mall security guard. It's like you're kind of a cop, but you're not really.
And you're waiting for the terrorist to take over the mall so you can redeem yourself. And
yeah.
Or you're waiting for the terrorists to take over the Nakatomi building so you can help John McClane kill that terrorist at the very end of the film.
There you go.
I think if Travolta's character were still alive today, he'd probably be Paul Blart.
Or maybe Seth Rogen in that other
Observe and Report or whatever it was.
Yeah. The one thing that I really like about the film is, and I agree with you, I think this is a much more mature film for De Palma in one way, in that it's a film that is beautifully stylized. The compositions are very deliberate, very well done. You talked about the owl and things like that. The one thing that is not all over the place in here that seemed to just mar a lot of his work both before and after this, not Scarface so much, is the split screens. And to me, split screens kind of take me out sometimes, but this sort of split composition thing that you were talking about that allows us to have things, you know, in the foreground, in the background, both in focus and really well composed, I think it's a much more restrained film in that way, and better than just sort of how off the rails a lot of the split screen stuff gets from time to time.
I agree with you, because the split diopter, am I saying that right? That's what the term is for what he does in Blowout, correct?
Yeah. Yep.
I've
heard both split focus diopter and then just diopter shot, that kind of thing.
Well, that technique is really in keeping with the theme of the movie. As I said, you know, the relationship between sound and voyeur. And I think that when he does similar effects like the split screen and other movies, that maybe if it takes you out, it's because it isn't in keeping with the theme of the movie. You know, I'm completely on board with the split screen in Carrie. I love the idea that you see Carrie's reaction on one side and you see all the havoc she's causing on the other side. I can see where it would take you out of the movie in some of his other works. And I think his editor, when I spoke to his editor, he felt the same way about it. He never liked the split screen. And he would argue with De Palma, saying, this takes people out of the movie. It's you showing off. What are you doing? so it's a very valid criticism.
One thing that I notice is that, I mean, obviously, here's a filmmaker who came up on the East Coast in the early mid-60s. So for him, the use of split screen, probably influenced by something like Chelsea Girls or something, like going to underground film and going, oh, look at what Warhol can do with these juxtapositions of three images, and trying to figure out how he could take those kind of concepts and put them in together. Because before he really started doing it in mainstream film, I don't think a lot of people were doing a lot of split screen work.
Well, he was definitely doing it in his underground days, that's for sure. Like Dionysus 69 is split screen. I think it's split screen all the way through, which I thought was great. And I love that he comes from this underground filmmaking background. And you can really see a lot of, you know, the themes that he explores, even in his earlier films, kind of go throughout his entire body of work. And I think that kind of maverick ideal is what led him to be able to challenge our visual expectations and use this kind of stuff, you know, trying all these different, I don't want to say tricks, but the diopter shot or the split screen, both of those, they're not really used very often, or if they are, they're pretty sparing. I talked about Tarantino earlier. I can think of a couple diopter shots that were in Reservoir Dogs, like with Marvin Nash in the foreground and Mr. Orange in the background. You know, but that's like a couple shots in there. It's not like the whole, you know, not like, I think there's like at least 15 of these diopter shots that were used in Blowout. And each one of them is very effective, or like they may not even look like diopter shots. They may not look like split screen where you have the, you know, either the line that's visible or implied, like when Jack and Sally are talking on the telephone. But the idea of the tire being blown out as Jack's got his headphones on and he's listening, and you see the tire right next to him as it's going by kind of in slow motion. It's just like, that is really fancy kind of stuff.
The stuff that's used really well and is composed really well, and you've talked about the TV with him in the background and things like that, are shots that don't look like anything. You know what I mean? They're just shots. Like if you see them and you didn't know that it was a trick shot by using that split, you wouldn't know. And to me, I think that works well. To me, that almost goes back to, matter of fact, my mind on terms of the composition and being very, you know, formal and well done is I often think of that shot in Citizen Kane where he's typing the review and Joseph Cotten's character is over here and they're having this dialogue. And of course, you know, Kane's in the extreme foreground for us, and having that where we know that that's a trick shot. We know that now. But at the time, it was two shots that were put together. So, but it worked so well as something that was composed supposedly within one frame. And that's really what I like about the film, in that he is very deliberate in terms of the compositions. And it works really well, but it's not tricky. You know what I mean? It's not calling attention to itself. It's working in aid of the story.
Well, this is another thing that these camera tricks that De Palma employs, another thing that they do. We already talked about how he doesn't like to use coverage. So he's thinking, you know, what visual tricks do I have in my arsenal that I can utilize? And what these techniques do is they're very efficient. It's a way to cram as much visual information into a sequence as possible.
Just going back for a second, Rob, you were talking about the conversation that they have at the movie studio. I love that conversation where they talk about the five films in 2 years.
How many years we worked together?
I met you on Bloodbath, right?
Yeah.
And then we did Bloodbath 2. And then we did Bad Day at Blood Beach. And then we did Bordello of Blood. And then, well, that brings us up to date, Co-Ed Frenzy. By the way, I didn't tell you this, but I'd like to think this is our finest film.
Almost 2 years.
Oh, God, 2 years. Five films in 2 years. What are we doing?
You know what I can't figure out? I can't figure out what a smart guy like you is still doing that shit for.
Oh, come on. You do this shit. I do the sound.
Oh, no, you do the shit.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, like that wind in the trees. It sounds like you're whistling in the crap.
That's the library stuff. We used it a million times.
That is the trouble. I have heard it a million times. Now, get something new.
New wind.
Yeah.
Got it.
And what about that scream? We gotta dub that.
All right. You know any good screamers?
I got a few ideas.
Yeah, I bet you do.
Yeah, yeah. Just worry about the screen, will you, huh?
Well, one of the titles that I laughed when I saw this again because I didn't remember the titles of all the films, but one of which actually became a film is Bordello of Blood, of course. So
yeah,
so I had to laugh about that. Oh, okay, well, that's where they got that. So
that was such a nice nod when that one came out.
But the one thing that was really nice for me, and this is a little bit of nostalgia, is the whole dubbing stage scene and him with the mag track and the tape and the Nagra and all that stuff. I did all that like when I was 19, 20 years old. And it was like the most fun you could ever have, just to have a sound engineer give you a Nagra, a reel-to-reel recorder and a set of headphones and a shotgun mic and go record sound effects, go get this, go get that. And then building those tracks and just building layers and layers of sound effects for the film. And when I had the opportunity to do that, it was just – I just had so much fun with it. And to watch him do this in the film and to when he's putting together the frame by frame reconstruction and syncing up the sound and everything. And I'm like, oh, an upright move viola. Oh, a gang sync, a squawk box. It was just pure nostalgia heaven for me because, of course, they don't do that anymore. Everything's all on a computer.
Yeah, that scene of him cutting out the magazine pictures and capturing them all frame by frame, taking still frames of those things, and then, yeah, getting that film later on, that whole – really, that it's almost a painful process, but it's such a rewarding process, especially in this film. But, you know, like him taking the film in and dropping it off and then coming back and then syncing it up and all this, just – it's – like I said, it's painstaking, but it just is so wonderful that De Palma's taking the time and showing us all of the steps and showing us basically what we're watching. You know,
yeah.
Just it's that stepping out of the movie to show us how the movie is made, show us how the sausages are made in this case.
You know, about a year or so ago, we did on the show Terra Firma, and we talked about movies about making movies. And although this really isn't about making a movie, it does have a lot of stuff about process of making movies. And I think by putting all of that in there, he really sort of gets you to question sort of what you're seeing, how you're seeing it, how it's all put together, and just sort of that whole process. And like I said, for me, there's a nostalgia aspect, but I also think that he's talking to some larger issues of obviously these corollaries with the Kennedy assassination and things like that that are sort of, you know, reconstruction and how reconstruction is done.
Well, yeah, it's like having Zapruder at Chappaquiddick. You know, and I love that De Palma can take those two things and mix them together and give you something that's, you know, that's a Reese's peanut butter cup. You know, it's even better.
I think it's indicative of his strengths as a filmmaker. You know, we all have influences, whether you're an artist or not. There are people that influence you in your life and your decision making. It's unavoidable as a human being. And I think when people criticize De Palma, they tend to focus too strongly on, oh, he's just a Hitchcock ripoff, blah, blah, blah. He takes his influences and he takes them to a different place. I mean, he uses them as a starting off point, and then he kind of takes them to his own unique place. And I think that that's ignored a lot about De Palma. And there's such a confluence of influences in this film. Like you said, between Hitchcock and Blow Up and Chappaquiddick and Zapruder and on and on and on. And I love that he throws that into the stew, and out comes his most cohesive movie for me. I think this was the moment in Blowout when every strength that De Palma had just came together beautifully. It was beautifully synchronized.
Well, yeah, you can play the game when you're watching De Palma's films and say, where was this from, or what was this influence, and that kind of thing. Like, you know, even like watching Phantom of the Paradise, and when the Phantom comes in and sticks a plunger over Beef's mouth, it's like, oh yeah, this is totally, you know, Psycho. Or you see, you know, so much of Vertigo in this film, or you see so much of Rear Window in this other film, or a mix of the two, like when it comes to Body Double. But this is one where I don't see that. This isn't one where it's like, oh yeah, there's some fireworks at the end. Well, that's kind of To Catch a Thief, but not really. He's using it in a totally different way. It's not like you can do that game when you're watching this film, or at least it's a lot more difficult than it is when it comes to other things. It's not like Sisters, where you're like, oh yeah, see the way that he's watching them across the way, kind of like Rear Window or any of that stuff. It's definitely... You're right. It's more of a cohesive thing, and it feels more like an original product that way.
The only direct thing that I found in here was, as I was talking about, that reconstruction scene where he's listening to it and he's building the film with the stills and the audio and all that stuff. That almost seems like a direct lift out of Blow Up. Because there's a whole thing where in Blow Up he's taking the photos and he's blowing them up and he's putting them on the wall and he's trying to figure it out and he's going back to the scene and he's doing all this stuff. And it almost kind of it's almost a direct scene. The only thing is he's dealing with the ear as opposed to the eye. That would really be the only difference between those two things.
The title Blow Out was not the original title for this film. It was Personal Effects was the first title for it, which I found it to be a very interesting title, really, because you've got both the idea of the sound effects and them being your effects, but then also that whole idea of personal effects. Usually, you know, when you talk about someone passing away, you are given their personal effects. And so it's just this kind of nice play on words that way. And I think him going to blow out was definitely much more of a throwback to Blow Up, which I think is a very nice homage that he's doing with the title. And you're right, there's definitely some nods back to Antonioni, but I don't know, the thing when it comes to Antonioni's films, at least the few that I've seen, it always feels like somebody took his movies and put them in a pot of boiling water, boiled out all the emotions, and then what's left is what gets projected on screen, because it just never feels like I care about any of the people in his films. It always feels like a bunch of sleepwalkers going through the motions, whereas with Blow Out, I definitely felt like there was so much emotion, and I really cared for these characters.
There's an operatic quality. There's a very visceral, tragic tone in Blow Out that isn't there in Blow Up. He was probably fascinated by the voyeuristic aspect of Blow Up and how that could be employed in the service of a thriller, and he wanted to take it to a different level. I mean, I you know, there are all kinds of filmmakers, and I admire Antonioni, but I don't think he was primarily concerned with you caring about the characters. That just wasn't necessarily his primary objective. You know, it takes all kinds. People said the same thing about Kubrick, that he was very cold about people. And you really had to dig in deep into Kubrick's movies to find out just how compassionate they were. And now I find more compassion in Blow Out than a lot of De Palma's films, because they tend to be very cold. I think he bleeds. I think he weeps for Jack and how he ends up at the end of the movie.
While I was doing some research on this film, I found out that before Blow Out was Blow Out, back when it was Personal Effects, that there was a screenwriting contest for this film, you know, be the screenwriter of the next De Palma film kind of thing. And I tracked down the guy who won the contest. So I want to take a break and play back the interview with Bill Meschi Jr., the winner of the Write Brian De Palma's Next Screenplay. I'm sure I'm butchering the title of the contest itself, but the winner of that contest. And he's got some interesting insights on what all he wrote made it to the big screen.
I'm Bill Meschi. For the last 3 years, I've been an adjunct instructor at several schools in New Jersey. And before that, I did 27 years at Home Box Office in their corporate communications area. And before that, I was in publishing for a little bit. And while that was paying the bills, I would occasionally get a screenwriting gig. About 13, 14 years ago, I started getting some stuff published. But the other stuff is what was still paying the bills.
So how did you get involved with Blowout?
I think I had been out of school 1 or 2 years. I had this really horrific job out in the Jersey swamps with this little company updating TV listings for those little free TV guides they give out at supermarkets. And I was subscribing to a couple of film magazines, and one of them was this fairly young one called Take One Magazine. Things were tight. I had actually discontinued my subscription, but I got one more issue, and it's where they announced this screenwriting contest that they were doing in conjunction with Brian De Palma. That's how I stumbled into this. It was for a project at the time he was calling Personal Effects, and that turned out to be Blowout.
So what was the ad like? What were the rules of the contest?
He had a scene-by-scene breakdown, and what you were supposed to do was pick two scenes, write the hell out of it. They'd take the best of the two, then the finalists would be asked to draft a whole screenplay, and they picked the winner out of that. So the plot line never really changed a whole lot, but originally it was set in Canada. I don't know why. I think it had something to do with production breaks. And then when I did my version, I didn't know anything about Canada, so I reset it in New Jersey. Well, obviously, you've seen the film. It wound up set in Philadelphia.
So what was your version of Blowout?
The paradox of it was, and this is with all respect to the guy, I was never a particular De Palma fan, not because I thought he was bad, but he, by his own admission, he's a stylist. He's not overly concerned with narrative or character. So I had read those interviews, and I thought I had a beat on him, so I wrote what I thought was a very De Palma-esque script that would give him stuff that he could really run with visually. So even though I didn't mess that much with the plot, I really ran with the characters and the settings. For instance, all of the main characters were a little bit stylistically overcooked. The main guy, the guy John Travolta played, I had him as some kind of burnout case living in this little storefront out on some back road. No furniture, nothing in there but recording equipment. He was just completely buried in his recording. The girl, who was always supposed to be not the sharpest pencil in the box, her place, it was all pastels and stuffed animals. And the killer, he was a gamesman. So his place was just nothing but games. And I thought, you know, great, this will be something he can really play with. Then he decides to do a very un-De Palma movie. He tries to do something very contrary to what was typically his style. And sadly, I think even though it was reviewed well, I think that's why it didn't perform well, was because all the De Palma fans were a bit disappointed, and the people who didn't like De Palma, who probably would have liked the film, didn't go because it was him. So I think the movie fell in that chink. It was mostly changes in style. Like I said, I didn't mess with his plot that much, but I was just trying to give him some cinematic meat to chew on, and then he decided to play a different game.
So I guess I jumped ahead a little bit. I should have asked about winning the scene stuff first, right? Because
yeah,
then you win that before you get to do the whole thing.
Right.
How was that? I mean, obviously there's probably no remuneration at that point.
There was a small $500 kick if you made it into the finals there. And then if you won, it was a contract and $9,500. So altogether, it was a $10,000 thing, which for me at that time, well, I could use it now. But I mean, it was a very big deal. But to be perfectly honest, what I really wanted and what I legitimately did not get was a screen credit, because that you cannot put a value on. That's what gives you the cachet to get the next thing. I remember I had no agent at the time. I hadn't done anything. I was a nobody, and that value that I would have gotten from the screen credit, that would have been worth more than the 10 grand. But he didn't keep enough of, I didn't actually know how credits worked at the time, and I was kind of burned that even though he didn't keep that much, I was kind of hoping for some little token credit. But as I've gotten older and I've learned more, I know that for the amount of material that he did retain, I didn't really rate a credit. But that was, for me, the big frustration.
Yeah, you couldn't even get a story by credit, right? Because you were kind of given the outline or whatever beforehand, right?
Well, the credit that you can get thrown, I learned this about 17, 18 years later on a low-budget movie I wrote called Road Ends. I remember I got a call from the guys who were putting the picture together and saying, well, the company wants to give you an associate producer's credit. I says, what for? I didn't do anything except write the script. He says, yeah, but they like you, and they're not going to give you any more money. This is what they give you. So there is things they can throw you. And again, it really depends. I mean, look, I never met the guy. It's not like we had some kind of relationship. I only ever got one phone call that I missed, and I got one two-sentence letter saying, congratulations, you're the winner. And that was it.
So you're not out in Hollywood having story meetings and drinking martinis and...
No. That, like I was telling you about Road Ends, I was in... I had gotten flown out to L.A. to talk about that, and it was a very small picture. I think the whole budget was like $1.6 million. And how the scale is different. Chris Sarandon was one of the stars and one of the executive producers. So he and Rick King come by this little dinky motel I'm being put at, and they kick me out for coffee. And I think I had to lend them change to use a payphone. So not exactly the Hollywood dream come true, but actually, I mean, they were very, very sweet guys. It was just that's the scale that we were working on. So, no, I didn't get – Columbia didn't fly me out anywhere. As a matter of fact, I didn't even know they were making the film. After I won, I didn't hear anything more. And I wrote him a couple of letters. Back in those days, people still wrote letters. There was no internet. And I asked, so what are you going to do? Is there going to be rewrites? If you're going to rewrite this yourself or get another writer, is there going to be a novelization? People still used to read then, so they used to do novelizations. Anything I could get to either get another paycheck or try and get my name on something. A couple months go by, I get another two-sentence letter saying essentially that my services were no longer required. That's that. Another couple of months go by, I get my first agent, and I tell him about this. He says, well, I'm supposed to have lunch with somebody who knows about this. I'll ask him. He comes back from lunch, says, well, they're not making the picture. C'est la vie. I go to see, I think it was Dressed to Kill. And in those days, there was, I don't remember the name of it, but there was a little freebie movie magazine that used to get given away at some movie theaters. There's an interview with Vilmos Zsigmond talking about his latest gig as a cinematographer on this film for Brian De Palma. And I'm reading the plot description. I'm going, boy, that sounds awfully familiar. Now, it's under a new title.
We're sorry, but we've run out of time. Be sure to listen to the rest of this episode at jackaloperadio.com in the Projection Booth archives. And be sure to leave your feedback at projection-booth.com. Stay classy.